This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In America, we like to think of ourselves as a largely classless society. Most of us, even those with higher incomes, think of ourselves as middle class. But in reality, the U.S. is made up of different classes, each with their own worldviews and life experiences. And when two people of different classes come together in marriage, the result can be challenging. We don't leave our pasts at the altar. We bring with us our experiences, our opinions about money, about friends, about customs, expectations, and how to conduct ourselves in certain situations. That baggage, well, that is baggage that cannot be ignored. Jessie Strive is an assistant professor of sociology at Duke University, and she's been studying this. The result is her book, The Power of the Past, Understanding Cross-Class Marriages, and she joins us for the hour from Durham. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And with us in our studio is Nancy Norman, a licensed clinical social worker with the Carolina Counseling Group, who deals with married couples. And we'll talk about your experience with regard to this as we go through the program. Thank you for joining us, too.
Thanks for having me.
So, Dr. Strive, what made you want to look into this? Because this seems to me to be a kind of a very small subset of things. But what made you want to look into cross-class marriages?
Yeah, actually, there's more cross-class marriages than you would probably think. About 4 in 10 married couples who both are college-educated come from different class backgrounds. And I actually really wanted to study them because they're this big group of people who are coming together across class lines in a time where the rest of the country is coming apart across class lines. So socially, we're becoming more different by our class. Geographically, we're living farther and farther apart from people of other classes. And economically, we're earning very different amounts now, according to our classes. So these couples kind of represented maybe what's possible and what we could learn from and how we can come together across class lines, even when we're coming apart in so many other ways.
And we're going to talk about white collar versus blue collar, but how many different classes really in America are there, and how many unions are there of these widely disparate class distinctions?
Yeah, it's a hotly debated question, how you define class and how many there are. I only look at two. I look at the middle class and the working class, or the people who are from professional white-collar backgrounds whose fathers were college-educated, and people who grew up with fathers who worked in blue-collar jobs and kind of working-class jobs and who had a high school degree at the most. And that kind of captures a lot of America. It leaves out the extremes, the wealthy and the poor. But it's a good swath of who we are.
You know, given the differences in class and all the things that you just talked about, how we seem to be coming apart as a society around class and moving further apart, we have upper class people working and living in gated communities, and we have lower class people who can't find housing that they can afford, et cetera. And we have kind of a battle witness in Washington between opinions about class and how things should be treated. So how is it that two people in this environment where classes are so are separating and becoming farther apart, what is it about these two people from different class backgrounds that makes them want to get together?
Mm-hmm. So the people I talked to, their lives started to converge by class. So they often met when they were in college or when they were at work after they had graduated from college. So these are people whose class backgrounds were different, but who were going towards the same class future. And what that happened was they really felt drawn to each other because of their class differences, even though they rarely thought of them as class differences. So, for example, people who grew up in the working class with blue-collar fathers and blue-collar communities, they often felt that their world was a little bit unstable. So unions have declined, giving blue-collar workers less power. There's less of a safety net now for blue-collar workers than there had been in the past, and job security is lower for blue-collar workers in the past. So they kind of grew up with a sense of things could change at any moment, that financially things weren't what they wished they were, and that a bad thing could happen at any point. And they met their partners who were from these white-collar backgrounds, more privileged backgrounds, who had benefited from the rising returns to a college degree and from a lot greater job stability for their parents. And so they had this sense that the world was stable, the world was predictable. And to these people from blue-collar backgrounds who met them, they were just kind of awed by the sense that life was going to be great. And they really wanted that sense of predictability that their partners provided. And it went the other way, too. So people who grew up in more professional white-collar families often found something they didn't like about their past that was common among people of their class, but less common among people who grew up in blue-collar families. And this drew them together. So the people who grew up in professional white-collar families often said their families weren't as intimate as they wished they were. So one thing that happens in a lot of middle-class families is kids are placed in a lot of activities. They're going to camps, they're going to tutoring activities, they're in sports, they're in music. And all these things, while they're great in a lot of ways, remove them from their family. So they spend a lot of their days away from their siblings, away from their parents. And because these activities are so expensive and time-consuming, a lot of people in blue-collar families can't afford them. So they grow up just hanging out with their families much more, and the people from privileged families really appreciated the sense that you could just kind of hang out and talk and without doing a scheduled thing, and mm-hmm. that really drew them to their partners from blue-collar
families. So in each case, we have people who see things about themselves that perhaps could be fixed in some way or completed in some way by the other person, essentially?
That's exactly right. Yep.
In your practice, Nancy, you don't deal with cross-class necessarily marriages, although that's part of it. You deal with all kinds of marriages.
Right.
But is that a normal thing in any couple where opposites do in fact attract? And is that why they attract? Because there's something about that other person that fills a missing part of you?
I think that's the case. We're drawn to somebody who can help us develop who we are, or who brings something to the table that we don't bring. So I think that's a universal theme, sort of backing up what Jesse has studied.
But when you have a situation where you come from different class backgrounds, so your experience with money, your experience with the way you handle arguments within the family, the experience with how you handle, and we'll talk about this, leisure time among family members is very, very different.
Yes.
Is it more dangerous to be attracted to that person because it may not work out as well, in your opinion?
Well, I think you have to figure out, you know, maybe the difference between what you value and seeing it from that perspective, and not necessarily looking at it in a real fixed way. So I think it's recognizing that, you know, you may have patterns or ways of doing things, and some of those are beneficial and some of them aren't. You know, in some of Jesse's research, talking about, you know, hurts that maybe someone in a particular class had from an experience. So I think when you're dealing with a clinical perspective, it's trying to understand the difference between what's normal and fine mm-hmm. in terms of behavior, and then what's maybe getting in the way of a person connecting to your partner or to someone else.
And when you're working with couples in this counseling setting, is most of what you work with the result of these differences, whether they're cross-class differences or other kinds of differences that have to be resolved? Because although they may have seemed attractive at the beginning, they are points of friction as time goes on.
Right. I think Jesse refers to them as fatal flaws, perhaps.
That's right.
I think it's again, trying to determine what's adaptive and doesn't need to change, and then what piece of it gets in the way of helping you connect to someone, to yourself, and then also to your partner or to someone in society at large.
How would you define a fatal flaw, Jesse Stribe?
There are things that draw us to people that we really like at first, but later become the things that divide us. So, for example, these people who grew up in blue-collar families really appreciating at first that their partners seemed so stable and that the world was just going to be so great and predictable, and then later resenting their partners because they didn't understand that they didn't feel this way and they couldn't empathize with that, and they didn't necessarily then see the world the way they saw it. And so it could become a source of division, even though at first it was a source of attraction.
Do most of these differences, are most of them apparent to people in the courtship phase of relationships? Do they see them as differences, or do they simply see them as attractive characteristics of the other person that makes them want to be around that person, only to discover later on that they are differences?
People like to see themselves as very similar at first, and the similarities they would tell me that they initially saw in each other were so broad and so vague that I always wondered who wouldn't have this similarity. So they said things like, we both value treating other people well. That's so important to us, and that's what kind of similarity drew us together, where we both think family is important. And so people found a way to construct being similar, even when there were a lot of underlying differences.
We're talking about cross-class relationships, cross-class marriages, and some of the things that people run into. They're both positive and negative. There are some positives to this that we'll talk about. And we want to hear from you. Have you been in or are you now in a cross-class relationship? How does your background come up in your relationship? You can get to us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. This morning, Charlotte Talks on WFAE. In these cases where differences are the result of class distinctions, do the couples involved see themselves as coming from different classes or simply that they are different? I'm not sure that this is important, but it seems to me that it might be important because if you're the white-collar person and you're looking at a blue-collar person that you find very attractive, do you think of them as coming from a different class and the other way around?
Very rarely did the people I talk to actually think about class in their daily lives.
Hmm.
And so they...
But I'll bet the parents do.
Less so than you would probably think, but some of them. And I think the reason why is because when they met, they were often both in college or both had graduated from college. So they focused on their similarity and where they were going in the future and didn't really focus on their different backgrounds and the classes they had come from. And so while class was affecting their lives in so many ways, they often experienced it as we're just two unique individuals in love. We're not affected by our class at all. That's in the past. We're in the present. It doesn't matter.
A moment ago, you talked about people experiencing the instability of life in the lower classes as the economy has changed because jobs disappeared and people, you know, couldn't find new jobs to replace those old jobs, and they saw the people from the upper classes leading these very stable lives. But in the recent recession, a lot of people in the upper classes lost big time jobs and had very big time trouble in replacing those jobs. So are you talking about a previous generation, an older generation that didn't live through that, or are you actually talking about the post-recessionary generations?
The people I talked to were raised previous before that. But even if you think about the recession, people who are college educated were certainly hit hard. But people who weren't college educated, who had high school degrees, were hit much, much harder. So even relatively, people from lower class backgrounds might look and say, hey, your life is still pretty stable compared to mine.
How different are these cross-class marriage problems that crop up from any problems that crop up, Nancy, in a relationship between two people?
I think there's just a lot of similarity, and I think that's why this topic is very universal, because I think, you know, difference is difference, and it doesn't always matter necessarily. I mean, what's valuable about understanding the origin of something is because if you're having a problem with it, then it helps you find a solution. But, you know, I think there is a universality to this issue of difference and seeing how we are the same and can we appreciate harmony, because that augments and makes something better.
Nancy Norman is a licensed clinical social worker with the Carolina Counseling Group. She's with us here in our studio. And in Durham, Jesse Strive, the author of The Power of the Past, Understanding Cross-Class Marriages. She's also a professor of sociology at the Duke University. We have to take a break. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about cross-class marriages today with Jesse Strive, assistant professor of sociology at Duke University and the author of The Power of the Past, Understanding Cross-Class Marriages. Nancy Norman is also with us, a licensed clinical social worker with Carolina Counseling Group. High society elders... This is apocryphal now. I've only seen this in the movies. Used to advise their children to marry well. Is this what they were talking about? Stay within your own class, do you think? Jesse?
I do, or marry up to the extent that you can if you're already at the top. Yeah, I mean, there's a common idea that, you know, it's great to marry up. I think that idea kind of overlooks a lot of the differences that you're going to have to deal with. And even the people who I talked to who married up and up far enough, a big enough gap that it was very obvious to them, it was kind of an ambivalent thing for them. So... in one way, you get all these resources, which is great, and have access to this lifestyle that you never had before, which can be great. But it also can be uncomfortable of not knowing the norms, of feeling judged because you're different, of feeling like maybe your in-laws are kind of a little bit suspicious of you. And so while there's a lot of great things about this advice of mirroring up, or if it happens to you, it does, but there's also a lot of drawbacks that I don't think people think about as much.
You keep going. I took a breath.
when they think about it abstractly, I don't think they think about all of the challenges that a cross-class marriage can bring.
You know, as I was reading what you had to say about this and as you were talking, what comes to mind is the chauffeur in Downton Abbey who marries into the Crawley family and all the challenges that he faces because he's from a completely different class at a time when class really, really matters. But in your book, you say there's a school of thought that individuals from different classes mix like oil and water, put them together, and they separate. That does not bode well for a marriage.
That's true. And what I find is that's, you know, not always true, that this theory can be wrong. But the idea behind the theory is that class shapes, of course, what we have, but what we have shapes who we are. Mm-hmm. It shapes how we want to go about our daily lives, what we expect out of our lives, what we consider normal, what we do for fun. And so when we meet somebody who's from a different class and they're different on all those dimensions, we don't understand them. We don't always want to be around them. It takes more work to communicate with them. And so we often go our separate ways. And so that's the theory. But what I found, like I mentioned before, is that these differences can also bring us together. And even in a marriage, they can be strengths about, you know, how do you deal with a problem? You have two different approaches now. And so you can figure out the best one to use in a certain circumstance.
Have you found that to be true, that these areas of friction that may have been attractive initially have become areas that, gosh, why can't you just get with the program here? Why do you do that? Can that reverse itself with counseling? Can you help people see those things as positives?
Because
they saw them as positives originally, probably.
Right. I think, I think it's the pattern of things that always makes it difficult to stay in a long-term relationship. And what I mean by that is just sort of the thing that happens over and over again. It's not the occasional, you know, aberrant behavior. Mm-hmm. It's the thing that happens over and over. And I think, you know, part of what Jesse highlights is the difference between maybe your values and not necessarily having to compromise on that versus a behavior that might not be... Like, you know, if you come from a blue or a white collar class, say, for example, and you're marrying someone who's in blue collar, you know, you see you're attracted to the idea of intimacy and connectivity and sitting around and just connecting. So, you know, I think being drawn to that might feel uncomfortable for you, but you could learn to do that. So I think it is possible to reverse things or change if you as an individual see the value of what that brings to the table. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where it's important, I think, to distinguish between, you know, what's at the base of driving a behavior versus necessarily getting caught up in the behavior.
Dr. Straub, you say that tastes matter in a marriage, but that sensibilities matter more. What do you mean by that?
That's right. So by taste, I mean preferences for an object or for an activity. So having a taste for a type of art or for a type of music or a sport or even a person, whereas a sensibility is a way of going about your life. Kind of if somebody asked you, how do you want to spend money or how do you want to raise your kids or how do you express your emotions, how you would normally do those in a daily scenario. So taste can be very contained. You know, we can contain it to what movie we're going to watch on a Friday night or what radio station we're going to tune into on the car. And they're not really huge areas of friction. We can understand people have different preferences and put up with them. But sensibility is how you want to go about spending money or attending to work or hanging out more broadly in your leisure time, of raising your kids. These can be really huge differences in our life.
But they matter a lot more. But it seems to me like your taste in a radio station, for instance, if you're an NPR person and you're married to a hard rocker, this might provide a problem in the car, it seems to me.
It might. But I don't think you're likely to get divorced because you can't reconcile your radio.
Oh, yes, you are. You talked with your subject about, and we've kind of tap danced around this, so let's talk about it in specifics. You talked with your subjects about seven aspects of daily life: money, paid work, housework, leisure, time, emotions, and parenting. And the different classes see these things differently. And as we've already talked about, in some ways, they see the way the other person from the other class approaches them as a better way, and they want to emulate that. How can it be done? First of all, can you emulate that if you've grown up in a different way of looking at these things? And how does it all come into play in a relationship?
So the differences that I discovered were really systematic. So systematic that strangers who had never met each other had more in common if they shared a class background than people had in common with their spouses. And so how these systematic differences played out was that the people from higher class backgrounds often wanted to manage things. So their money or their time or their emotions, they wanted to kind of plan it all out, organize their thoughts, and follow kind of a procedure that they've laid out. And their partners who grew up in blue-collar families often wanted to go with the flow and take things as they came. And you can kind of relate these back to the different circumstances they grew up in. So if you have a lot of resources and you have money and you have power and predictable lives, you can make a plan and it's probably going to be seen through. If you don't have a lot of money or power or predictability in your life, it makes more sense to go with the flow because even if you make a plan, something's probably going to come up that's going to make it hard to carry out.
We did a program not too long ago with somebody who moved from being chronically poor, grew up in a chronically poor situation, always homeless, never being able to plan and even being able to pay the light bill, to someone who has become a PhD and now has a stable life, and she helps others who are poor kind of get their lives in order. And one of the things that she pointed out is that when you come from that background, there's no use in planning because every time you make a plan, it's going to fail because the next thing that comes up may cause you to not be able to pay the light bill or pay the rent because you've had a medical bill or you've had an accident in a car or the car broke down. So if you come from that background, you don't have the habit of planning. So then planning, if your partner has that, that looks very attractive, doesn't it?
It can look very attractive, especially at first, and then can also be a big difference.
But if you reverse it now, if you're the person that's always grown up in this stable life and you can plan and you want to plan and you want to be a manager, maybe this laissez-faire attitude of your partner who comes from a different class background looks attractive initially, but wouldn't it be maddening in the long run?
Often, yes. Exactly. So especially a number of the women would say to me, you know, I met this guy and he's so laid back and it's great. And then after a time they said, but I wanted a partner. I wanted somebody to plan my life with me. And they don't want to plan and they don't want to take control. They want me to take control and tell them what to do. And that felt really kind of not like the marriage and the partnership that they had in mind. Mm. So it did become very maddening to a number of couples.
You deal a lot, Nancy, with cross-cultural relationships, and you lived overseas for a long time as well. So there must be similar situations in cross-cultural relationships as with cross-class relationships, correct?
Yes, I would say that there is a lot of crossover and similar experiences.
How do they present? How do they manifest themselves?
Well, I was listening as Jesse was talking, and I guess part of how we can help someone bridge some of these differences is maybe seeing the utility of both. So when it comes down in a practical perspective, as far as like who's going to clean the toilet and some of those practical things, I mean, I think what Jesse's saying is ends up being conflictual for couples. And so you do have to negotiate that because I think part of that is, you know, what do you expect of an adult? And I'm sort of making that into a broader perspective, it can be very challenging. I mean, because you have all of these ideas of what your roles are from a gender perspective. And that certainly is influenced by your culture and then also by class, because there's some kind of predictable roles that you have based on gender.
Mm-hmm.
So I think maybe seeing the value of both, but also understanding that, you're going to have to negotiate because you're living with this person. And that a lot of times couples will say to me, you know, they kind of look to me as the expert, and it's kind of like, well, you know, I don't have to live with you.
Yeah.
You know, the person who's living with you has to live with you. So that's what you've got to negotiate.
So you discovered, Jesse, that ideas on how to spend money, attend to work, divide household labor, display emotions, raise children are all likely to spark more vehement disagreements, correct?
Correct.
Are those likely to be more sharply differentiated in marriages involving people from different classes? Because all of these things seem to be things that could just arise in the course of two people coming together from the same class.
Yeah, and I talked to people who married somebody who grew up in the same class as they grew up in and who are currently in the same class as they grew up in. And while both sets of couples had to deal with these differences, the content of their differences were different. So the people who crossed class lines in their marriages often had these managerial and kind of laissez-faire, going with the flow, differences, whereas people who grew up in the same class often were on the same page that they wanted to organize, to plan, to manage their lives, but the degree was sometimes a little bit different, or exactly over what could be a little bit different. So they might both say, you know, we want a budget, we want to stick to our budget, we want to plan out our financial future, but there'd be a specific thing that one person thought they should buy that another person didn't, and there might be a dispute about that.
Because I would bet, although I've never been in one of your counseling sessions, but I would bet, Nancy, that you spend a lot of time talking to people about money problems, about how to divide up the household chores, who cooks, who cleans, who takes care of the kids if I've had a rough day, if both people are working and they've had a rough day at the office, about how to have an argument, how to express emotions, whether it's love or anger, about how to treat with children. I'll bet you this is a major point of contention in all these things that you talk about, correct?
Absolutely. I think that's why Jesse's book is so universal, is because it's raising things that that you know, all of us can identify with. And you know, I was thinking about, you know, the show today and you know, thinking, for example, if you are going to meld two approaches, perhaps as a couple, if you come, you know, you value what the blue collar partner has to bring to the table in terms of being more emotional and talking about how they feel about something, what their experience is. So maybe at the beginning of a conversation, you discuss it from that perspective. And then perhaps you bring, you know, you draw on the strengths of the white collar partner, mm-hmm. who can be more managerial or, you know, look at it from a more practical perspective. And, you know, maybe that's the second phase of the conversation where you're going to be more problem solving and get into, you know, I'm just trying to think of like, how do we meld these two things? And I think so, you know, sort of seeing the value of both. And that's probably, I think, what Jesse, what her research showed was that, you know, the couples who are more accepting of each other versus trying to change their partner ended up having a more successful union.
Adam emails, I'm in a cross-class and mixed ethnic marriage. Her family's upper middle class from Thailand, and I'm a working class Charlottean. There are not many differences except in the way we talk about raising children, of which we currently have none. In upper middle class, the woman usually stays at home and raises the child. In working class families, whichever person makes more money keeps working. If you can live off one income. Also, she makes me turn off WFAE when we're in the car, so there is no radio. You see, that is a major problem. It's a major problem, I tell you. What is that typical, Jesse?
No, actually. So women work and raise and stay home at not horribly different rates by class. We're starting to see, I think, some differences, but the differences aren't all that broad. So that's not kind of a universal difference. And often there's a lot more differences in every other sphere of your life that people are less similar.
We're talking about cross-class marriages today on WFAE's Charlotte Talks. So give us some examples of how this plays out. There's a couple in the book. Blue-collar approach to money is spend it, live for the day. Why?
So I think there's two different reasons why. So one has to do with the way you were raised. So if you don't have a lot of money, you don't have a choice but to live for the day. You can't save it if there are bills coming in and debt collector is calling. So that becomes an approach that you just have to take. Whereas if you have a lot more money, you can save and not live for the day.
And that makes sense. But this also plays out differently in terms of emotions, because you say that people from blue-collar backgrounds expressed emotions as they felt them. They spent their emotional capital at will. And people from other backgrounds don't necessarily – they're more reserved. Why?
I think it has to do with the jobs their parents were in. So if you are in a professional white-collar workplace, you're often trained to express your emotions in a particular way. And the training's not formal. There's not an information session you would go to, but there's a norm. And you know, in order to get along, you express your emotions very rationally. You intellectualize them and don't make a big scene. And if you grew up with parents who worked in a factory or something like that, there's not as much pressure to regulate your emotions. And so people teach their children the emotional style that they have to enact every day at work, and it gets passed down that way.
So what impact is, and I want to hear from both of you about this, because you deal with this whether it's cross-class or not. What impact do these things have? If somebody is effusive with their emotions, and the other partner is reserved with their emotions, whether it's anger or love or gratitude, whatever it may be, how does that play out? Nancy.
Go ahead. The couples I talked to, this was actually one of the biggest differences that they appreciated the most. And so the people who grew up in white-collar families kind of really thought this was a really honest way to express your emotions, to express them as you felt them, and to express a wider variety of emotions, a wider range of emotions. And likewise, the people who grew up in blue-collar families often thought, wow, they just really articulate their emotions so well, and they're so calm about it. And isn't there something kind of to admire about that? So this was actually a difference that really drew them together, that they appreciated, that they tried to emulate their partner's style. So it was kind of a good difference.
So we have 20 seconds. Can you add to that?
Just augmenting the same thing in terms of, not really. She said it well.
Okay. Nancy Norman's a licensed clinical. She knows when to stop talking. A licensed, you talk. You're here to talk. A licensed clinical social worker with Carolina Counseling Group. And Jesse Stribe is the author of The Power of the Past, Understanding Cross-Class Marriages. There are pluses to cross-class marriages, which we will get into when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about cross-class marriages, but many of the things we're talking about with regard to the differences among people or between people of different classes is applicable to ordinary same-class marriages. Jesse Stribe, though, studied these folks and is an assistant professor of sociology at Duke University and the author of The Power of the Past, Understanding Cross-Class Marriages. Nancy Norman's also with us. She's a licensed clinical social worker with Carolina Counseling Group. We've talked a lot about the differences and some of the downsides of these cross-class marriages, and yet there are positive. There is an upside, because you say, doctor, that the marriages you studied are not only the result of individuals tolerating or overlooking their partner's cultural differences, but blooming because of these differences. How so?
Well, it gave them two different strategies to approach different problems. So sometimes the partner who maybe didn't plan a lot would have a problem come up at work, and they would then turn to their partner and say, I have to get all these different things done by this deadline. Can you help me make a plan of how to do it? And so they were strengthened in that way. And similarly, their partners would say, you know, sometimes my partner really pulls me back and helps me smell the roses and not live in the future all the time, to really enjoy the present. And so they found ways to really bring in the best approach of both of their worlds and to help each other live those out.
Well, if opposites attract, and they do, and you're looking to fulfill yourself because the other person in the relationship brings something to the table that you don't have, does that normally happen? Can you bloom, and do people bloom ordinarily, whether they're in the same class or not, in your experience, from the differences in the other person?
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you can see, you know, for example, a good strategy is to say, well, what do I agree with? Like if a couple is having a conflict, what is it that my partner just said? You know, there's the value of listening. There's always that when you're communicating. You know, we forget that listening is a huge piece of communication. So, you know, I just lost my train of thought. But
well, we're talking about how people can benefit from the differences of their partner.
Yeah, and seeing, you know, what do I agree with, and then where do we go from there? I just saw that this weekend with a couple who, you know, they were discussing the possibility of getting married, and was she going to adopt taking his name or not, and what that brought up, and her partner was able to listen to her and really see, oh, I can see why you wouldn't want to give up your name. I don't want to give up my name, and so they were able to, you know, they haven't come up with a solution, but they're each feeling appreciated. You know, she's feeling appreciated for what she's going to be giving up if she changes her name, and he's appreciating that, you know, that would be hard. Like, if I had to do that, that would be hard. Mm-hmm. So that's a really good example of how, you know, this would be something that is a point of friction, but can we come at some kind of understanding, and what do we agree with?
You primarily looked at Jesse Strybe, middle-aged, white, heterosexual couples. I'm curious as to why you decided to focus on middle-aged, white, heterosexual couples, and curious also if you had studied a more diverse group or other groups, would you have seen the same kind of results? Would you have seen the same friction, the same blooming tendencies that occurred in these folks?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the reason why I did that was to try to hold as much constant as I could, so I could isolate the effects of class while not having them conflated with race. And so you want to kind of make sure everybody's the same race, and the people who I lived around just happened to be white and mostly heterosexual. I think there might be differences if I looked at a different group. So one thing about whites in particular is they're more segregated economically than people of other races. So middle-class whites live farther away from working-class and poor whites than, for example, black middle-class people do from black working-class people and black poor people. So there's less interaction among the classes, among whites, which might make these differences harder to deal with because they're more hidden. They're, you don't have as much practice dealing with them as you're growing up. And heterosexuals, I think, also have their own maybe special challenges. So people who grow up in mostly heterosexual communities and live their adult lives in mostly heterosexual communities are more likely to be around people of their same class. So the bigger your group is, the more likely you are to find people who are similar in it. So because gay and lesbian communities are smaller groups, they're more likely to be around people of different classes if they're kind of matching with people who are of their sexuality. Hmm. So actually, I think these problems could be heightened for white heterosexual people compared to other people.
Okay. If differences between people, Nancy, are a point of friction, this has come up a couple of times. How do you learn to listen? Because it seems to me that, and I think you brought this up a few minutes ago, that listening is a key here. You can ameliorate a lot of problems if you just listen. You may not agree, you may not understand, but if you're listening, how important is that?
Well, I think understanding, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh said this, that if you want to love someone, you need to understand them. And I think that's really true. So if the goal becomes, instead of being right, can I understand you? You're going to have a different approach to what is being said. And I think that's a huge thing.
Do you think that this cross-class, the problems and challenges and the positives that come from cross-class relationships are substantially different from those that come from relationships of any kind among people?
No, I don't think so. And I think, when I was thinking about doing the show, it struck me how universal the themes that Jesse's research highlights and brings up, you know, how much they apply to all of us, regardless of whether we're the same class.
You're a sociologist, Jesse. So as a result of this research, what's your take on that?
I think there are big differences. So there's parts that are universal, like, you know, wanting to listen to your partner and understanding them and not trying to change them, that I think are applicable no matter what your classes are. But I think the differences that you deal with and the magnitude of the differences, the content of the differences, and how easy it is to understand your partner differ by if you marry somebody who shares your class background or if you don't.
You also see another benefit, Doctor, in the cross-class marriages. You say they tend to lessen inequality. That's interesting. How so?
That's right. So there's a benefit sometimes not just for couples, but for society. So if you imagine two people who are recent college graduates who are getting together and they come from privileged class backgrounds, chances are they don't have a lot of debt, and so they don't combine their debts. Their parents both have connections that can help them get jobs, and their parents are also more likely to have some extra money that they could help their children build some wealth with by, for example, paying for a down payment on a home. And so they have all these advantages. And if you have two people who come from less privileged class backgrounds, chances are they have more debt that they combine when they get married. They have less of a safety net, and they might actually be their parents' safety net. They might have to send money home. and their parents have fewer connections for them to rely on. So when you have one partner from each class, you kind of even out that difference. So instead of consolidating privilege or consolidating your debts and your lack of privilege, it evens it out. And so if we have a lot of cross-class marriages, we have a little bit less inequality.
So rich plus rich equals a combination of wealth. Poor plus poor equals a combination of debt. Rich plus poor equals a rising tide?
Yeah, a little bit. That's a good way to put it.
It does. Could it work in the opposite direction, though? Could the poor person who suddenly has access to money become the spendthrift and bring the whole thing crashing down?
I guess theoretically that could happen. I haven't seen it happen,
okay.
But it's always possible.
Which brings up this. When you have a cross-class relationship, does the other person in the relationship change in some way because of their relationship with their spouse?
Surprisingly less than I would have predicted. So one of the big findings is that the class doesn't come out of the person even after the person comes out of the class. And if you stay in your class, your class stays in you. Even if you're married to somebody who grew up in a different class, even if your class is different than the one you grew up in and you're completely immersed in it because of your college degree, because of your job, because of your neighborhood, because of your friends and your networks. And so mostly we don't change a lot, even if there's somebody asking us to change and even if we're around people who are quite different than us.
Because you do write about that. You say that cultural differences may be insurmountable, not just class differences, but cultural different taste differences. You say that even after years of sharing resources with one partner, trying to get the other to, say, attend a cultural event or a lecture, even respected and loved partners were unable to convince their spouse of the value of those experiences. Is that because you can take the person out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the person?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I mean, people made compromises. So they would go to the art museum with their partner because it was important to their partner. But they didn't start spontaneously wanting to go to an art museum when before they had never wanted to do that.
Can that lead to problems? I mean, if your tastes in entertainment and leisure time activities are so great, I like art museums, I like classical music, I like going to the theater, and you like NASCAR. You like hard rock. You like, throwing the frisbee in the park. Can that lead to problems, Nancy?
Yeah, I think so. If you don't recognize what underneath all of that is of importance to you. So, you know, if you don't have things in common, then really what's more important about that is not that you don't like necessarily the same things, but then you're not spending quality time together.
Together. You don't enjoy the same things together.
Right. So I think it's about finding, again, it's kind of like sifting down things to a more fundamental value or what gives you significance, what's important to you in relating and connecting to another person and your partner. So I think if you can negotiate that, then you'll be okay. But if you can't, ultimately, you're going to end up, you're going to value something that you're not getting in the relationship.
But if you can't change the person, can you get beyond the fact that, okay, we're just not going to spend a lot of time together. We're just not going to spend a lot of leisure activity. I'm not going to go into the park and throw a frisbee with you, and you're not coming to the concert with me. So, all right, I'll go by myself, or I'll go with a girlfriend, or I'll go with another person. That's okay. You can learn to live with that.
As long as there's connect, whatever you define as a person or as a couple, what's significant and what gives you meaning in terms of if you can negotiate in another way, maybe you have coffee together in the morning or you have, you eat dinner together, for example. As long as you're getting essentially what you want in terms of what's important to you about why are you in a relationship.
Anne emails, my husband comes from a working class background, was the first in his family to go to college, and grew up in a small house, sometimes a trailer in the country. Everyone in my family has been to college, and I grew up in a big house in the suburbs. Our differences influence our worldviews. He's always wanted lots of money and a big house. But for me, having grown up with those things, I saw my father work so hard to keep up that kind of lifestyle that it damaged my parents' marriage. For me, it's not worth it. I'd rather be thrifty and happy, but he desires wealth because he's never had it. That's probably our biggest struggle. That's an interesting point of view. Did you run into that in these couples that you studied, Jesse?
Yes, that was a very typical answer. So, people who grew up poor, they hear their whole lives, hey, work hard, make it, get some money, and then they want to spend it, and they want to show people that they no longer have the stigma that was associated with their past. And if you never had a stigma and you always could buy what you want, sometimes money is just less important to you. You kind of take it for granted more. And so you had to negotiate kind of what money meant to you and how you wanted to then spend it.
We're talking about cross-class marriages and Jesse Strive's book, The Power of the Past, Understanding Cross-Class Marriages, today on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Let's get back to leisure time, because there are differences in how people like to spend their time. And you bring up in the book the story of Scott and Gina. And Scott misread something about Gina in their courtship period. She liked to skydive. He was kind of an adventurer, an outdoors guy, and she liked to skydive. And so he saw that, well, this is going to be great. But that's pretty much all she wanted to do. She didn't want to do much else outdoors. How did that play out in the relationship?
Yeah, they had more trouble with leisure time than anybody else I talked to. So they met on JDate, on online dating, and so on her profile was that she liked to skydive. And so he was really excited about this because to him it symbolized adventure. And the way he thought about adventure was not necessarily through skydiving. He had never actually done it. But that he wanted to travel the world. He wanted to backpack through Italy. He wanted to travel all throughout Europe. He wanted to go skiing. He wanted to experience new activities all the time. Mm-hmm. And Gina really didn't. She liked skydiving a lot, but she really was happy staying at home and relaxing. She didn't need to know what was going on in the international world. She wanted to know what was going on in her own community. And so this caused a lot of problems for them, mostly because Scott thought his way of doing things was much better than Gina's. So he actually dumped her before they got married. He pursued a woman in New York, in Manhattan, who led this kind of very cultured life that he really admired. But this woman that he dated was really into her career and wouldn't put his career first. And so he moved back home, back to Michigan, went back to Gina thinking, oh, I'll change her, right? Of course, you know, backpacking through Italy is something everybody would love. If she just tried it, of course she'll love it. And, you know, she can give up her white bread, which to him was a symbol of backwardness, and, you know, eat these healthy things and try new foods all the time. And so he spent 10 years trying to convince her to do this, which, of course, didn't make her feel good and didn't make her feel valued for the things that she likes. And she tried, but she never really liked these things. And so eventually Scott kind of gave up and he said, well, you know what? I'm going to appreciate her for her resilience, for her willingness to put up with me trying to change her and it not working. And he just started going on ski trips to Utah and traveling around the world by himself. Mm. And Gina stayed home and it worked as well as it was going to work.
So what's the takeaway here? I only have 30 seconds. Are you setting yourself up for failure if you don't recognize, acknowledge, and work through class differences in a marriage? Or can you? Is it like any other thing? You just do it as it comes about?
I don't think you have to know that there are class differences, but I think you have to be willing to live with and appreciate somebody who's different than you.
Do you agree with that?
I would.
Nancy Norman is a licensed clinical social worker, Carolina Counseling Group, and Jesse Strive's book is called The Power of the Past, Understanding Cross-Class Marriages. Didn't get a chance to talk about the rising tide of women earning more than men, and if the men in the relationship are from lower classes, where they expect to be the breadwinner, is that a problem? So you'll have to read the book because we didn't get into it. Thank you all for the hour.